So what are you thankful for this holiday season? I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today on the Larry Miller Show. And of course, gotta say thankful for Larry every day. But of all the things that we would be thankful for, I did not have this at the top of my list, and maybe I should. We're joined this morning by PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, an entomologist, and we're talking about bugs this morning. And if you have any bug questions, we invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. If you have pictures to send, you can send them on, and we'll take a look at them in the studio. Email talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. And PJ Leash, welcome back to the Larry Miller Show.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Of all the things to be thankful for this holiday season, friends and family, of course, top of the list. WPR listeners, they're just friends I haven't met yet, or family that's supporting me today. Thanks for listening, Mom and Dad. But bugs, we should be thankful for bugs this holiday season. Leave it to an entomologist to put the insects at the top of our list. Why, PJ?
There's really a whole bunch of different reasons, and insects are the single most abundant and diverse group of animals on the planet. If you think about it, if we made a list of all the vertebrates, those are animals with a backbone, so you and I, dogs, fish, cats, birds, stuff like that, and we come up with a list and we have that number, there are beetle families that have a longer list than that, and there's over 100 families of beetles. So it's mind-boggling how many insects are out there, and they're doing things that, unless you take the time to take a close look, it's very easy to miss what they're doing. And of course, I mean, this is true in life. The squeaky wheel gets the oil. So when there are insect pests that are doing something we don't like, that is going to get our attention. But the overwhelming majority, like 95%+ of all the insects out there, are doing something beneficial for us in the ecosystem. And anytime they do something like that, we refer to that as an ecosystem service. And another way to phrase that is it's something Mother Nature is doing so that we don't have to. They are pollinators. Mm-hmm. And in general, roughly one out of every three bites of food that we eat is due to insects. And you might say, well, what about the other two-thirds? And, you know, especially our Western diet, very heavy in things like corn and wheat, which primarily wind pollinated. But if we were to go to the grocery store, look at the produce section. A lot of that is because of insects. So a couple things that really came to mind with Thanksgiving, cranberries. I love cranberries. Cranberries. We need insects to have that cranberry sauce on the dinner table tomorrow.
I'm so proud of my cranberry sauce this year. Like, I'm bragging about my cranberry sauce, but I'll also have to add that insects are partly responsible for my cranberry sauce.
Yeah. So things like that. Also, other, you know, produce, vegetables, pumpkins,
sure.
Squash. So
sure.
The pumpkin pie tomorrow, if you have baked butternut squash or anything like that.
Thank the bugs.
Exactly. So pollination, that's a key, really important thing. And I feel most folks can recognize that, but they also do a lot of really important things in terms of like decomposition and nutrient cycling. They're nature's garbage men, if you think about it that way. But they're just working in the background to break down rotting plant material, roadkill, stuff like
sure.
that.
Yeah.
Get the nutrients back into the ecosystem.
They're the start of our food cycle. They're the end of our food cycle. And they yeah. are points in between to our food cycle that if one out of every three bites of our food relies on an insect to make it possible, if you take the insects away, we're going to have a very clear Thanksgiving table.
Exactly. And then, you know, they are a base of food webs, as you just mentioned, mm-hmm. critical to our food webs. Lots of things feed on insects. That can be fish and aquatic systems, plenty of terrestrial things, birds feed on them, including turkeys. Turkeys can be omnivores, feed on a range of things, and that can include insects. So when you're eating that turkey tomorrow, you know, if it was a wild one that maybe you hunted out in nature, they were probably feeding on insects somewhere along the lines.
So they play a crucial role in our lives and our food cycle. But what about the pests, PJ, and how they, like you say, are the squeaky wheel and get the grease and get all our attention, that everything else seems to run almost on its own in the background. But what about when they get in our way?
Yeah. And that, again, when it comes to public perception, if we were to walk down the street and poll people, insects, good or bad, you're going to get a mixture of thoughts. In a lot of cases, it may slant to the negative because it's a few of those bad apples in the bunch that get her attention. You know, some insects are kind of hard to show love for. Mosquitoes, I say, would probably fall into that category.
PJ, but, do you love mosquitoes?
You know, there are some neat ones out there. I mean, there are plenty of mosquitoes that have no interest in biting humans whatsoever. Mosquitoes can
be
pollinators.
We love those mosquitoes.
You know, when they're biting, maybe not.
Right.
But they are a base of food webs and aquatic systems.
Yes.
Above ground, dragonflies and birds and things like that are feeding on them too.
When you're on and we get calls in, we regularly hear people concerned about the reduced population of bugs, that we used to see them everywhere and now we don't see them anywhere, that they used to cover up our car windshield in ways that would make us stop to clean it off, and we don't have that experience anymore. The fields of lightning bugs have disappeared from my yard. Those stories like that, do those stories concern you, or are those a part of the big picture of the life cycle of the insects?
Yeah, great question. Those stories do concern me.
Okay.
And when you think about it, I mean, we just talked about all the really critically important things that insects can do for it. And we touched the tip of the iceberg. We could have gone on and on for a full hour on that. They do so many important things for us, but we are seeing a growing body of evidence that insects are facing threats and are declining. It's hard to study this. They're so small. There's not enough experts to look at all of these. But again, there are studies coming out all the time. One recent one came out of Colorado, or I should say it was published by a researcher in North Carolina, if I remember correctly. But the research was in southwestern Colorado, beautiful area. My wife and I love to head out there. And this was a habitat area up in the mountains that relatively untouched by humans. It's not like it had been, you know, bulldozed and made into apartments and malls and stuff like that, relatively untouched. And over the course of time, the number of insects have been dropping over the years. And that is very alarming. You could understand, you know, a habitat that's highly modified by humans.
Mm-hmm.
You can kind of say, yeah, that makes sense. But when you're looking at kind of more wilderness type areas and insects are declining, that's very alarming.
Are there hypotheses as to why that is?
There are, in the general consensus at the moment, and this is something that I think we're going to hear more and more about over the coming decade or so, it's that there's not one single cause. It's really death by a thousand paper cuts. There's all these interacting factors. And I like to make the analogy, if it were one single thing, we just flip that one switch in the other direction and fix it. It's a whole bunch of things. It is land use change, human activities that could be agricultural or just building, the way that we design the landscape around us. You know, if we put in a turf grass lawn and that's the only thing we have in our yard, for example. But there's other factors too. This is related to weather and climate. Climate change is being looked at, especially the study I mentioned in southwestern Colorado. Mm-hmm. They think that is one of the things. They'd notice you have a really warm year and the following year, insect populations down. Drought is also being looked at. So with climate change and more extreme weather patterns, that can be really hard on insects. So again, it's a whole bunch of interacting factors, makes it really hard to kind of tug out which are the main ones.
So PJ Leash, if I am as thankful for insects as you are today, what could I do for their population?
Yeah, great question. And a couple of really simple things that come to mind. And these are things that I feel anyone can do in your own yard or in your neighborhood or just the general places where you live. That can be reducing the amount of pesticide that you use. In a lot of cases, or ask yourself, is that pesticide really necessary? You know, maybe you go out and you have some weeds. Could you do some alternative approach, hand picking or something like that? Or if you need to use a pesticide, could we use one that maybe has short persistence, is not going to last as long in the environment? Is it known to be less toxic, for example? I mean, along those lines, there's a very wide range of insect pests that I regularly answer questions for in home gardens and yards, that you can manage those pests with things like insecticidal soap and horticulture oils, which sometimes is just like a mineral oil or a soybean oil and things like that. You have to understand the limitations of those products, but if you use a soap or oil versus maybe a conventional product that's going to last for 2 weeks, you know, we can make some decisions there. And I think also changing human perspectives. You know, to us, we might see a weed in a lawn, maybe it's violets, for example, and some folks just don't want those in their lawn. But to us, we might call it a weed. To insects, that can be a food source. That can be pollen and nectar, for example. Along the lines of violets, there's actually a species of butterfly that specifically lives on violets. And so if you have violets in your lawn, you may be supporting that particular butterfly. If you don't, you're not providing any resources for it. So there's really a number of things we can do. Minimizing pesticide use. One interesting thing, especially during the summer months, there's evidence about light pollution. There's actually a term for it, which is ALIN, artificial lighting at night. And we know that this can disrupt insect behavior. We know that moths in particular often like to come to lights. But think of a very charismatic insect, fireflies.
Right.
They rely on light to mate for their behavior. And if they're being distracted by all these strings of patio lights and things like that, there is building evidence that light pollution and artificial lighting at night can be harmful to insects.
So there, those are really simple, some low-hanging fruit and something each and every one of us can take the time to do if we are as thankful for insects as you are today, PJ Leash. And to me, it's interesting that an entomologist sees the smallest parts of the world that we're not even looking at most days. But that changes the big picture of the world that you see compared to the rest of us. So to see the world through your eyes is not just looking at the smallest things, it's looking at the whole globe and how all of these parts are crucial to making, you know, to putting us here today, to putting the dinner on our plate tomorrow, to bringing us together, friends and family alike. You can thank the insects for that.
Definitely.
PJ Leash, our guest today, entomologist, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, giving thanks today, and thankful for you as well. If you'd like to join the show, if you have questions about the bugs that you've seen around your home, or maybe who have been imported through some fresh Christmas decorations, give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're also taking pictures of your insects today with your questions at talk@wpr.org. You can email talk@wpr.org. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Taking a look at the insects around Wisconsin today, along with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Our guest, PJ Leash, entomologist and manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Let's go to Lee in Green Bay next. Lee, good morning.
Good morning. A couple months ago, I stumbled across what I call the ground hornets or the ground bees. I was doing some brushing on my property, and I didn't know that hole was there. And I'll tell you, that's the worst I've ever been stung up bad.
How many times?
I left the nest alone. And will they come back? Will there be a queen that'll winter there or whatever?
Yeah, great question. PJ, what's happening to the ground bees over the winter?
Yeah, so what it sounds like is you probably bumped into, I suspect, ground nesting yellow jackets, which due to their size and the appearance, their coloration, they have these very conspicuous black and yellow stripes. Folks often mistakenly call them ground bees. Mm-hmm. What I think of as a ground bee tends to be very different. These are solitary creatures. Their nest, it's one individual, looks like a little anthill, very docile, very gentle. The only thing that's going to live in the ground is like a colony would be bumblebees. And most folks recognize bumblebees because they're
big and
usually
fat.
Larger, robust, very hairy in terms of their appearance. Mm-hmm. So when someone is like mowing their lawn and they get stung by a bunch of things, it's almost always going to be ground nesting yellow jackets. We've got a couple of common species like German yellow jacket, Eastern yellow jacket that'll do that. Now, the biology of these is they have annual life cycles. And to be honest, bumblebees have basically the same kind of story. So the colony naturally dies out in the fall due to two reasons. One is starvation. They run out of resources. They are predators. They also can be pollinators and go for nectar and pollen. Well, as the plants start to senesce and insects feeding on those plants, i.e. their prey disappears, they starve to death. If they're still hanging on and we get a cold frost like it is today, that would finish them off too. The only members of the colony that survive, those colonies in kind of latish summer will produce a batch of new queens. They leave, they mate, they mix the gene pool, and then those queens go somewhere sheltered and they hunker down. That could be a rotten log or somewhere else. In spring, it's a roll of the dice and it's a mad dash. Those overwintered queens are trying to establish nests, and the vast majority of them will fail. They get eaten by something, or, you know, something happens and they just do not succeed. It's going to be a small percentage, but when those queens are out in spring, they're going to be looking for potential nesting sites. They're generally not going to go back to an old nest. And a reason for that, well, what if that nest or nesting site had died out because of a disease, for example? Mm-hmm. If you go back to the same spot, you're setting yourself up for disaster. So they're looking for new spots that can include things like pre-existing holes in the ground. They're not great diggers to begin with, but if there's a start of a hole, maybe it's an old chipmunk burrow, gopher hole, something like that. Maybe it's a location where a tree stump is there and it's rotted away and there's a hollow void. They can get in there and build a nest, but at first it's that lone queen. She's got to do all the work, get food, make the nest, raise young, and so on. Over time, she builds a workforce. They go out and do the more dangerous work. She stays there. So the colony builds up from spring, reaches peak size in about August, September. That is why so many folks have this situation where you've been mowing all summer, no issues.
Right.
All of a sudden, the colony's at peak size, maximum number of mouths to feed. They're also hangry because they're starting to run out of food. So they get kind of ornery. In August, in September,
right.
That's when stings happen. But the good news is two things. First, that nest has died out by now.
Okay.
The second thing is, just because you had one this year doesn't mean that they're going to be back next year.
Thank you for the call, Lee. And it does bring me back to mosquitoes. What are mosquitoes doing right now? Where are they?
Depends on the type of mosquito.
How do they overwinter and come back every spring like they do?
Depends on the type of mosquito. So we, in Wisconsin, we've got about 55 different species of mosquitoes. These are spread out a bunch of different genera. So, you know, if you think of it as kind of genealogy, you've got the Smiths and the Larsons and stuff like that. You know, these are different genera, and then there's species within those genera. And each genus can have kind of its own habits. So we have some genera and some mosquitoes that overwinter as eggs. And so those might be in low-lying areas out in the woods.
Okay.
The females laid eggs there in these spots that are prone to holding water. And that could be water from melting snow in spring. That could be rain, flooding events in spring or summer months. And that kind of lights the fuse, and those eggs hatch and develop.
How long can those eggs stay dormant? Generally.
It depends on the mosquito. Some are going to hatch relatively quickly. Some that go through that strategy, like our floodwater mosquitoes, the eggs might sit there for a year, two, three, four, or even more, just waiting for the right conditions when those rains come. We do have other mosquitoes, like the genus Culex. Culex pipiens is a northern house mosquito. That's one that's associated with West Nile virus, like in urban areas,
ooh,
for example.
Yeah.
But also the genus Anopheles, which historically had been involved with transmission of malaria in places like Wisconsin. You go back to the early, mid-1800s, we had malaria here in the state of Wisconsin. Nowadays, not an issue for us, but Culex and Anopheles, they can overwinter as adults in sheltered locations. So last weekend, when it was about 50 or so, I'm cleaning my garage and I find an adult Anopheles. And you might say, mid-November, we shouldn't have any mosquitoes.
That's exactly what I'd say, PJ.
If you understand, well, this is a type that overwinters as adults. They are looking for some sort of sheltered, buffered location. So that can include garages and sheds. Out in nature, that might be a hollow log, a rock pile, a small cave, or rock overhang, or something like that.
They're not biters, though, are they?
Well, this time of the year, they're pretty lethargic.
Yeah.
But in theory, you know, if it got warm enough in November, in December, really any time of the year, they could potentially become active. Now, probably not really aggressively trying to get a blood meal at this time of the year. Physiologically, they have some things that can kind of shut things down.
Okay.
They're not in the mode of laying eggs. But the point I want to make is when things warm up in spring, let's say we have an early start to spring and it's March and it's 65 degrees, there's some mosquitoes that can pop out right away because they were adults and have been there for months.
So it is possible to get a mosquito bite in Wisconsin in the wintertime.
Not likely, but it could happen. It could potentially happen. Again, if you had some of those like in your garage and they came into your house, could be possible.
Now, I have seen a lot of Asian lady beetles in my house this year, and I remember from past conversations that if they're already in your house, it's probably too late. So, but on the upside, no box elders. I haven't seen any brown marmorated stink bugs, and I believe PJ, these are the kind of bugs that you talk about trying to overwinter inside our house, and what we can do to try to prevent it.
Yeah. So there's a whole bunch of things: the multicolored Asian lady beetles, the box elder bugs, brown marmorated stink bugs. There's also something called a cluster fly. I've had lots of calls about this year. Every year, it kind of varies. It's up and down for each of those species. The box elder bugs, for example, they tend to do really well under drier conditions. If it's really rainy, really damp, they can basically come down sick with some fungal diseases. There's all sorts of pathogens that affect insects and help regulate their populations. So if we have, and you know, you rewind about two-ish years, and we had a couple years there that were pretty dry in Wisconsin, and I saw box elder bug populations build up. It's been rainier the last year or two at the right time of the year, and populations have gone back down. But it's been a really good year for the multicolored Asian lady beetles that like to get into our house. Lots of reports of those from around the state. I have seen plenty myself. So good year for those. Good year for cluster flies as well, which love to get into homes and cabins and things like that.
So what can you do once they're inside your home? Nicely escort them out?
My main recommendation, if you see an occasional one here or there, grab them with a tissue, get the hose attachment on the vacuum cleaner and suck them up. It generally doesn't make sense to spray indoors. From the point of view of those insects, they really don't want to be active in your house this time of the year over the winter months. From their point of view, they want to come in, find a sheltered spot, hunker down, spend the winter, leave in spring. They only have so much energy stored up in their body and fat stores and things like that. And so if they come into your living quarters and they're active, they're burning through the gas in their tank, so to speak. They are desiccating because it's pretty dry during the winter months. Pretty harsh conditions for them. So again, not great for them. These insects we talked about, they are not laying eggs or reproducing in our homes.
Okay.
They are just coming in and they're kind of wandering aimlessly.
Staying warm. They're coming in for a little warmth.
Well, they are. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If they were outside experiencing the brunt of the cold, that'd be very hard on them. But they get into a sheltered location and out in nature, that could be a hollow log, a rock pile, something like that. In the native range of those lady beetles we're talking about in parts of China, they actually will use visual cues and fly to cliffs.
What?
Where they see like horizontal and vertical cracks. That's where they go. They use these visual cues. And so when you think about our houses with siding, they're mistaking that for their native habitat.
Cliffs and cracks.
Basically, they're using those visual clues. And so that can orient them to houses. I see a strong pattern, especially if you're like a house out in the country on top of a hill, that can really orient them to places like that.
So take it for what it's worth this season, and then once we get to the spring and it warms up a little bit and they evacuate the house, try to find those little spots and close them up so they don't come in next season?
Yeah, that's the best thing in the long run. Figure out how and where they're getting in, seal that up. Caulk, expanding insulation foam, weather stripping, and so on.
PJ Leash, our guest, taking your questions at 1-800-642-1234, or email us, and we'll take your pictures as well, talk@wpr.org. Kathleen emailed us a picture of a Chinese mantis. It was photographed in their community garden just a few weeks ago. iNaturalist reported this Chinese mantis as invasive, saying, "We should destroy this bug." What do you think, PJ? What should they do with this Chinese mantis from just a few weeks ago?
Well, at this point, it's almost certainly dead. Even if you were to bring a Chinese mantis in the fall, they don't live terribly long. Their natural life cycle as they overwinter is an egg case, technically called an uetheca. In late spring, early summer, they hatch, they reach maturity in late summer. So that's when I get most of my reports. It'd be August to about October or so. They technically are not native here, but they are pretty much naturalized in North America. So also in terms of our ecosystem here in Wisconsin, I don't really get the impression that they are, you know, wreaking havoc on native species. So, you know, there's different terms thrown around, non-native, invasive, and so on. And if something is non-native, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a pest or a significant problem. I mean, think of ginkgo trees.
Sure.
Not native, but we have them planted and things like that. And so my thought is for praying mantids here, again, I don't see them wreaking havoc in the ecosystem. So I view them more as a curiosity. And I think there can be a big educational component. Folks just love to see these and watch them.
What makes a Chinese mantid a Chinese mantid? I mean, this looks a little, usually I see them as kind of a bright green or a lighter green, and this looks to be a little darker.
Yeah, I mean, with Chinese mantis, and the other species we get is the European mantis, which tends to be a bit smaller. So when someone finds a praying mantis in Wisconsin and it's about 4 inches, give or take a little bit more, that almost certainly will be the Chinese mantis. Their color can vary a bit, but usually brownish with some green on the body as well. Technically, the European mantis, if you were to look at the forearms, there's going to be a black and white spot basically where my bicep would be, and that helps separate our species. But we really only see those two species here in Wisconsin, so pretty easy to identify.
PJ, what about the news story from WPR's news on Monday? Danielle Kading from our Superior Bureau talking about the DNR and the state's debt cap on the lookout for an invasive species known as the hemlock woolly adelgid. I want to say aphid because when I tried to look it up online, the news stories all seem to, not here, but in the South, in Tennessee and stuff, say look out for the woolly aphid. What are we looking out for and how dangerous is it?
Yeah, so there is an invasive insect called the hemlock woolly adelgid, which is not native to Wisconsin or North America for that matter. It got into the country in the western U.S. about 1920s. Independent introduction got into Appalachia, part of Virginia, in about the 1950s, and it has really spread around almost the entire range of the Appalachian Mountains where you have hemlocks, and it has caused very significant damage there. Personally, I've driven through years ago some of the area near like Great Smoky Mountain National Park, and you'll just look out on hillsides and see dead hemlocks that have been killed by this insect.
Danielle's story says that it's killed millions of trees in the eastern U.S. and could threaten 80 million eastern hemlock trees here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, so there it definitely is a threat to us. So the range of it, Appalachian Mountains, but a while back, it showed up in Michigan, and it's in some of the counties that border in western Lower Peninsula. So it borders Lake Michigan, which will serve as a barrier to us. But especially northern Wisconsin, we have quite a few hemlocks. So there's definitely some concern there. These insects, they're related to aphids. They're very small, and it's death by about 100,000 paper cuts. Each individual one, they suck out a little bit of sap, of fluids. Doesn't cause that much damage, but when you have gazillions of these on a tree, they're all sucking fluids.
What's it look like? How would you describe that picture?
Well, the thing that folks might notice on plants, these insects will create a structure called an ovisac, this little whitish kind of cottony thing. So imagine if you took the cotton swab at the end of a Q-tip.
So it is kind of woolly.
It is kind of woolly, yeah. Hence the name hemlock woolly adelgid. It's on hemlock trees. If you were to just pull off a little bit of that cottony material from a Q-tip and kind of stick it on like the needles or twig of a hemlock. That's what it would look like. But again, when I've seen this in Great Smoky Mountains area, you will just see hemlocks where the entire undersides of all the needles are coated with these. So again, each individual insect is only a few millimeters long, can't cause that much damage, but these things gang up on trees and it can cause potentially tree death over the span of maybe 4 to 5 years. If you had high populations, low populations, it might take a decade, 15 years or so on. It's also interesting because for a long time, looking at winter temperatures, winter mortality of these insects, we thought, you know, it's probably just cold enough for us here in Wisconsin. They'd have a hard time catching on. But some of these climate models are predicting that maybe by about 2050, that's only 25 years from now, things might have changed enough that could allow them to get a potential foothold. So it's something that Myself, colleagues at DNR, Department of Agriculture, we're keeping a close eye on because it's not in Wisconsin yet, but it's something that we don't want here.
PJ, weren't you back in the day on the lookout for the Emerald Ash Borer before it got? And what was that experience like, and how would it compare to the efforts now to keep this woolly adelgid out of Wisconsin?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some similarities there. So the way I got my foot in the door with entomology was as an undergraduate student. I was at UW Parkside at the time, and I got linked up with a researcher here in Madison, did some initial field surveys for emerald ash borer, which wasn't here yet, or we didn't know of it at the time in about, this was 2005 or so. The similarities are that both of those insects, EAB, emerald ash borer, and hemlock woolly adelgid, very difficult, challenging to detect at low population levels.
Yeah.
And by the time you might potentially see a population, it might have built up and spread. So that can be a challenge with these. We know that something like hemlock woolly adelgid could potentially be moved with nursery stock, so trees,
yeah,
plant material.
Sure.
There's concerns there. Luckily, there's a lot of inspections and regulations with nursery stock and the plant industry. So DATCAP, Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, is heavily involved with that realm. But if someone moves firewood, for example, mm-hmm, that could be another route of introduction. And firewood is so much harder to regulate because you could have someone that just throws some in their truck and drives.
So the woolly adelgid wouldn't necessarily just be on the hemlocks. It could be transported through other trees or other wood?
No, it's basically specific
to
hemlocks.
Okay.
Yeah. But again, it's something that we don't have in Wisconsin yet. We are keeping an eye out for it because if we were to detect it early, that gives us the best shot at knocking it out.
What are the ways that we are trying to detect it early? Low population, you're trying to find the first one so you can nip it in the bud. How do you find that first? What is the system like for detection?
Yeah, so it depends on the situation and context. I mean, with something like nursery stock,
yeah,
you got trees that are 2 feet tall or thereabouts. You know, things like visual inspections to look for anything out of the ordinary. That's a very common practice. In forested areas, you're looking for kind of a needle in the haystack.
Yeah.
It's such a huge number of trees, large areas. I have colleagues at the DNR and Department of Ag that, again, are doing some work with this. My colleague Mike Hillstrom with the DNR Forest Health Team, for example, I've collaborated with him with a 3D printer in my lab to help create some of these traps. And it's a disc that can be placed out into a forested area, and on the disc are little microscope slides. And the idea is if hemlock woolly adelgid happen to be present, you know, if things are blowing around in the wind, if any of their genetic material, DNA, happen to rain down and land on these, that could be checked just to help confirm the presence. And this technique has been used elsewhere, like up in Canada.
This is a disc of little slides, microscope slides,
yep,
that you're expecting DNA to rain down on, and then you take these slides back to the lab and actually look for the hemlock woolly adelgid DNA to see if it's present.
Yep.
Amazing.
So that general technique of, rather than trying to find the actual organism, the needle in the haystack, can you find evidence,
yes,
of its presence?
Yes.
That can be successful. And that's been used other realms of biology, looking for invasive carp in rivers and stuff like that. It's called eDNA. So again, that's what colleagues like Mike Hillstrom and the DNR and a lot of the efforts were trying to catch it early, get that early detection. That might give us the best chance of knocking something out, or at least give us the greatest number of management options versus if it shows up and it's absolutely everywhere.
PJ Leash is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, entomologist, thankful for bugs this Thanksgiving season. And if you've got questions of bugs, we are about running out of time. So give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email to talk@wpr.org. Mark, we'll get to you next. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Hey, tomorrow at this time, it'll be Thanksgiving, and a happy Thanksgiving to you. And we will be celebrating with Thanksgiving Turkey Confidential, a live call-in program giving you cooking advice on the fly from the team behind Splendid Table. That's tomorrow right here during this time from 11 to 1. So if you need help tomorrow, tune in. Or if you just want to listen to other folks who need help on the Thanksgiving dinner, give a listen tomorrow from 11 to 1 right here on WPR News. With the time we have left with our guest, entomologist PJ Leash, I want to get as many questions in as we can, and we'll start with Mark in Sussex. Mark, good morning.
Good morning. The great show as usual.
Thank you.
And those yellow jackets you're talking about are predators. You know, they're meat eaters. They get a lot of caterpillars, so they have a purpose besides being annoying.
Well, that's kind of your argument for being thankful for bugs this season, PJ, is that they all have a purpose beyond being annoying, right?
They do. And one thing I've really come to appreciate over time is context is so important. You know, it's easy for folks to ask, is this insect good or bad? And I think in my mind, you know, if I went down the sidewalk and saw a person and asked myself, are they good or bad? It's not clear cut like that. And of course, if you have a yellow jacket nest right outside your front door, and every time you open it, you're getting stung, you know, that's not a good situation. If that nest is in the back corner of your yard, no one ever goes there, they're 30 feet up in a tree, they're great predators. They will come into your garden or go to your landscape plants, and they will feed on caterpillars, sawfly larvae, and things like that. They are hunting that protein source because their developing larvae need protein to grow. So they can be really excellent predators.
Mark, I appreciate the context. Let's go to Patty in Windsor next. Patty, good morning.
Hi there. I had some woolly aphids on my apple trees. I just planted them this year. They were bare roots, so they're very young and vulnerable. And it looked like cotton all over them. What's the best way to get rid of that?
Yeah, so we had talked about hemlock woolly adelgid. There's also a very common type of insect called woolly aphids, and there's a bunch of different species on a whole range of different plants. They can be very common on some of our fruit trees, including apple trees, and it'll look just like this fuzzy material. Mm-hmm. To be honest, my family, we went out apple picking this fall, and lots of them out there too. In many situations, if it's a larger established tree, the trees tolerate it just fine, and there's a lot of natural enemies, predators and parasites, that sort of thing, that will feed on those and help keep them in check. On a small recent transplant, you know, that's a situation where you may want to intervene just to get that tree off to a good footing. To do something like that with a small plant, a very easy option you could do would be something I mentioned earlier, which would be along the lines of either insecticidal soap, which you can get at just about any hardware store, garden center, also horticultural oils. The caveat with those is they work by direct contact. You have to spray them onto the aphids for it to work. Once they dry, they're basically done working. There's no residual activity, but that can be a good way to deal with aphids. So if I ever have an aphid issue that I feel I need to treat, those are usually my first options, is try an insecticidal soap or horticulture oil. That can usually work pretty well. You need to watch because any survivors can kind of repopulate. But if you treat today, maybe check a week later. If there's some more, maybe hit them again with the soap. But that can be a really simple option to deal with them and low impact, environmentally speaking.
If the woolly adelgid were to make it to Wisconsin, would I be able to see the difference between a woolly adelgid and a woolly aphid?
Well, you would rely on some important clues.
Okay.
You know, things like host plant would be a key thing. If I see
anything
like that on a hemlock,
Yes. That's
a red flag. But if it's a different host plant, especially if you have a general idea of woolly aphids and all, they can be common in some of those, then it's generally not a concern. But
gotcha. If
you are not familiar with them, you know, some of these aphids, some of the adelgids, they're like a tenth of an inch long. So even under the microscope, you're going to have a hard time. And they're kind of blobby-like creatures, not a whole lot of features to look at on them. So it can make it tough. That's why in my role at the Insect Diagnostic Lab, I have to look at clues. Phenology, time of the year, the host plant is a huge clue, and integrate all these things to figure out what the particular insect is.
Insect detective.
Exactly.
Leash. Patty, I hope that helps. Thank you so much for calling. We'll go to Jeff in La Crosse next. Jeff, good morning.
Hello. I'm calling about earlier in the show you had a part on the praying mantises.
Yeah.
And that reminded me of years ago when I was a more active gardener. From all the major garden supply catalogs, they offered these praying mantis pod-like things that you could hang in and around the garden to help control pests. But they wouldn't winter over, and so you didn't have to worry about them becoming a problem as an invasive species. But now with global warming, I'm wondering how dangerous that is.
Yeah, again, I still feel the, you know, the risk from these things is quite low, and I view them more of as a curiosity in my mind. Where we see them in Wisconsin, it's basically the lower tiers of counties, south central Wisconsin. I've had them up through Dane County into Sauk County on occasion, over to southeastern Wisconsin, maybe up towards like Sheboygan, where Lake Michigan kind of moderates things. I've never had a report of them from like up in the North Woods, for example. But again, they don't seem to be out there wreaking havoc in the ecosystem. Can they be predators? Yes. But usually what happens is, and Jeff, you're absolutely right. Sometimes gardening catalogs, you can buy what's called an uatheca. That's an egg case. It's this little styrofoam kind of consistency egg case. Those can hatch out. I have found these myself and overwintered them, got the young to hatch out in the spring, and you might get 100, 150 of them. What is going to happen, though, is you might get a few adults out of that batch. There's extremely high mortality. There's going to be cannibalism. They're just going to eat each other when they're little. A lot of them are going to die due to environmental conditions or maybe during a molt, a limb gets stuck or antenna gets stuck, something like that. And so out of 100, 150 eggs, you know, you might end up with a couple of adults out of that batch. You know, if you are rearing them and raising them in cages, you can increase the success rate. But I don't think of them as really being a great biocontrol in your garden because a lot of them are going to die. You can't contain them when they become adults. They can just fly off or they can walk away, that sort of thing. If I wanted to purchase a beneficial predator or parasitic insect, there's some other things I would choose. Things like lacewing larvae, for example, that aren't really going to be able to fly away because they don't have wings. So I know they're sometimes sold, but probably not really going to solve a whole lot of problems in your yard or garden for you.
Great question, Jeff. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Robin in Portage next. Robin, good morning. You're on the air with PJ Leash.
Good morning. I am going back to the Asian beetle.
Mm-hmm.
I have this question. I haven't seen a real ladybug for years.
Well, that
and
is...
Are they being killed off?
Oh, what? First of all, how would I know the difference between a real ladybug, as Robin, you know, refers to him as I know him, and the multicolored Asian lady beetle?
Yeah, so we actually have a whole bunch of different species of lady beetles. They belong to a family, Coccinellidae, which we just commonly call the lady beetles. I will say there are some species that most folks probably wouldn't recognize if they saw them because they're very, very small, like a couple of millimeters long.
Oh,
and they tend to specialize on feeding on things like spider mites and stuff like that. So very, very small, easy to overlook. There are, of course, are other lady bugs or lady beetles. And one thing that we've seen with this non-native multicolored Asian lady beetle is there has been some displacement of native lady beetles.
Okay.
And we do also have other non-native species of lady beetles that are out there that are basically naturalized at this point. But these multicolored Asian lady beetles, they tend to be physically a bit larger than some of our other lady beetles. And so if you are, you know, on a leaf and you're vying for food, aphids to feed on and stuff like that, and you're bigger and you can kind of elbow others out of the way, that's going to help you out. So some of that definitely has happened. We've seen some drops in populations of other lady beetles. They're generally still out there, but you really have to go looking for them in some cases. Whereas when you ask folks, what's the species they see in their yard?
Yeah.
A lot of cases, it's that multicolored Asian lady beetle. To actually tell that species apart, one thing to look for is just behind the head, they've got a region called the pronotum. It's this broad kind of neck-like region, and it's whitish, and there's going to be a black either M or W shape, depending on if you're a Badger fan or a Gopher fan.
Or if you're a Michigan
M or W.
Fan.
Yeah. Yep, something like that. But there's this zigzag M or W pattern that helps identify that species.
And that would be the multicolored Asian lady beetle with
yes.
the M or W, depending on who you're cheering for.
Yep.
Great question, Robin. Thank you so much for calling. I think we got time for maybe one more here. Tom in River Falls, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. My concern is I was recently skinning a deer, and between the hide and the meat, there were wood ticks.
Huh.
How common is this? Because I have never seen that or heard of that before.
Just to be clear here, you're skinning a deer from, you know, you killed for deer season, and as you take down the skin, you've got ticks that are between the meat and the skin?
That is correct.
How many?
Oh, I probably would say altogether maybe 10.
Okay.
I would find like a couple here and a couple there. You know, I first noticed them, and most of them were around the neck and shoulder area.
Interesting. PJ, what do you think?
Well, I mean, when ticks feed, they basically insert their mouth parts into the skin. They're not capable of burrowing in. In a situation like this, I'd really love to see some pictures of what was going on. What I wonder is if there had been some ticks on the deer and you're in the process of skinning it, those may have moved on. That's what I wonder about having happened.
Because the idea of a tick actually burrowing in and getting its whole body through that's not what ticks generally would do.
Right. They can't do that. They're not capable of burrowing in like that.
But that's the way Tom made it sound. So it's like most likely scenario is that once the deer was killed and that the ticks knew that their gig was up, that they started moving around, shuffling and trying to find meat.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I have a colleague, Dr. Susan Paskowitz, our medical entomologist, and her team has actually done some really cool tick research where years ago they would have folks from the lab at deer stations. So when folks are bringing in deer to register them, they were taking tick samples and assessing for things like that. So there's actually some cool research that's been done with deer hunting and ticks in mind.
Tom, thanks for the call. A quick one here, PJ, if we've got time for. Bill in Oregon emailed us. He's surprised to see moths and butterflies in early spring. Bill believes that most species overwinter in Wisconsin is either eggs or larvae. For the species that overwinter as adults, what traits or strategies allow them to survive Wisconsin's winter?
Yeah, so really, they have quite a few kind of tricks up their sleeve. A lot of insects that can survive the winter as adults, or really larvae or pupae for that matter, they have some physiological tricks. They can basically make kind of some antifreeze chemicals in their body that can help them. But especially for moths and butterflies, and there definitely are some that overwinter as adults, they are typically looking for sheltered locations.
Okay.
That's under loose bark of a dead tree, or a lot will get down amongst the leaf litter.
Sure.
On the ground. And think about it, if that leaf litter is then covered by snow, that really buffers them temperature-wise. So as soon as things start melting in spring, or if there's a warm-up in the winter, you could have some moths or butterflies, like the morning cloak butterfly is one I see very early in the year. You can bump into things flying around times of the year that you generally wouldn't necessarily expect them.
And that would be because of the overwintering as adults? And,
yes.
But I would imagine, like other insects, it's probably, you know, the odds are likely against you.
Well, again, they have these strategies to help them get into these very sheltered locations. If you are amongst leaf litter, covered by 4 or 6 inches of snow, even if it's minus 20 above, that space, the junction between the ground and the snow, it's called the subnivium. That's a very special, unique environment where that temperature is very much buffered and moderated, and that can really help them survive.
PJ Leash, today we are thankful for you. Thanks so much for joining us today, as always.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, appreciate seeing the world through your eyes, the big picture and the smallest pictures that we can find. Entomologist PJ Leash, manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And if you are interested, you can always send a picture his way. You can Google the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. You'll find the way to get PJ Leash your pictures. And when he's got the time, he'll get you the answers. When we continue on the Larry Mueller Show today, Wisconsin author James Campbell has a brand new book out, and you're going to want to hear about it. Cat lovers unite and take over. This is the heart of the jaguar and one of the biggest stories of conservation we've seen in this hemisphere. And that's after the news. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to the Larry Mueller Show. Good afternoon. You're listening to the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and our next guest you may know, especially if you are a regular Wisconsin Public Radio listener or an avid reader. James Campbell's new book is Heart of the Jaguar, the extraordinary conservation effort to save the America's legendary cat. You may also know James from his previous works, Braving It, which was featured on Chapter a Day, read by Norman Gilliland. The Final Frontiersman was a Chapter a Day special that was read by Jim Fleming. And James has joined Larry Mueller on this show before for his other books, The Ghost Mountain Boys and The Color of War. James Campbell, welcome back to the Larry Mueller Show.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
And I'm so glad I get to talk to you for this book, The Heart of the Jaguar, because I am a cat lover and I did not even realize how much... I didn't know anything about the jaguar. I didn't know that it used to be in the United States. I didn't know that it's still struggling to exist in Central and South America. What got you into the story of the Heart of the Jaguar?
Well, I guess I've always been fascinated with big cats. And in 1991, I was living in a small mountain town of 200 people above Boulder, Colorado, called Jamestown, and I was going to graduate school, and I read Alan Rabinowitz's work. He's the guy I write about in this book. His book was called Jaguar, and I was bowled over by it. It was about his 2 years in the Belize jungle studying jaguars, and Rabinowitz was a force of nature. He was fierce and fearless and iron-willed and lion-hearted, and he was very much like the jaguar. In fact, he said later on in his life that in order to write about and study and save jaguars, he had to be part jaguar himself.
It sounds so much like Jane Goodall and primates.
Very, very much. Yeah, he immersed himself in the jaguar territory down in Belize. He tracked them, he was tracked by them, he captured and collared them, and in the process, he amassed what is probably the most intimate and thorough record of the jaguar ever recorded.
I guess what surprised me, James, is how contemporary this all is. Alan Rabinowitz is somebody from our time, that this isn't... This is relatively new research, and the previous research into jaguars all seem to come from hunters or predators.
Yeah, that's exactly right. He did the first research in the rainforest. A guy named George Schaller, whose name I'm sure you know, was his mentor and his boss at the New York Zoological Society. And Rabinowitz also studied in the Pantanal of Brazil, where George Schaller had started a study of jaguars, but it was very different territory than the Belize jungle. And the Pantanal is 42 million acres. Ooh. It's the largest wetland in the world. And Alan Rabinowitz, kind of a funny story, he was chomping at the bit to go to the Pantanal, and he got down there and he just immersed himself in jaguar studies. And he learned, much to his horror, irony of ironies, that he was allergic to wild cats. So the man who would go on to be the most preeminent big cat researcher in the world was allergic to wild cats. It made him break out in hives. It made his nose run. It constricted his throat. So he didn't know what to make of that. But of course, his commitment never wavered.
Just for the record, as PJ Leash was exiting in the last hour, our guest from the last hour, meeting James Campbell for the first time, PJ said right out, "I've read Alan Rabinowitz's work. I have been been to Belize where he had done his research.
Yeah.
That this this goes beyond just big cats, James. This goes to the story of conservation. This goes to protecting the habitat we have for ourselves and we share with others.
Yeah, that's right. So he also studied clouded leopards. He studied tigers. He studied lots of big cats. But as he said, the jaguar was the animal closest to his heart. And he studied you know, big cats all around the world. But the jaguar was really where he made his mark. And he started a group called Panthera, which was an environmental nonprofit. He started that in conjunction with a man named Tom Kaplan. They wanted to be the Manhattan Project for big cats. And actually, Tom Kaplan brought him to Panthera and said that Alan Rabinowitz was the charismatic megafauna of his generation. The greatest brand name in big cat research and big cat conservation.
Well, the thing about your story, James Campbell, is you follow in the footsteps of Alan Rabinowitz. You go to many of these places and have the same experiences. The way you write about your first experience of seeing a jaguar is it's stressful. It's like you're looking everywhere for it, and then all of a sudden, it appears. And then all that stress sort of disappears, and there is this peaceful calm that takes place just as a result of the experience or just because of the jaguar. What was it when you first saw the jaguar in the wild?
Yeah, I was in the Brazilian Pantanal with a group from Panthera, and we were motoring in a boat down the Cuiabá River, which is kind of like the Kruger National Park of jaguars. They started a jaguar ecotourism effort down there in the early 90s, early 2000s, which has really blossomed. So we were motoring down the river, and we were scrutinizing the riverbank, and all of a sudden the boat captain slowed. And I looked off to my left, and I saw this jaguar laying under this tree. And then the boat pilot cut the motor, and he turned to us, and he said, "Onça." So Panthera onça is the Latin name or scientific name for the jaguar. But in Brazil, they just use onça. And then we came to stop, and he slowly let the anchor rope out, and we sat there and we looked at the jaguar, and this jaguar just laying there, you know, not perturbed in any way, unconcerned about us. And we were about 40 feet off the riverbank, and then all of a sudden he rose, and he rose so beautifully, so gracefully and fluidly, not like a dog happily jumping up, wagging the tail, hanging the tongue out. He just rose like it was like, I think I say it was something, it was like music.
Yes.
Like Steve Rinella, I did the Meat Eater podcast, and he said it rose like a runway model, which is so beautiful. And, you know, every muscle in concert. And then he got up and he came down to the river and he drank at the river. And again, it was as if he hadn't a care in the world and he wasn't worried about us. And then slowly he raised his eyes and looked at us. And then he just moved off again gracefully down the riverbank and disappeared. And that was my first sighting of jaguar, and it's, you know,
but you've
indelible.
Been looking for him for a while.
Two and a half years.
Two and a half.
Yeah. Along the Jaguar Corridor, which is a piece of land that unites ecologically important jaguar landscapes. Mm-hmm. Across a swath of 5,000 latitudinal acres. So it's huge. It has to be managed as a single ecological unit. It goes from the northern Argentina, the Iberá, to southern Arizona. And it's because the jaguar is the only large, wide-ranging species without a subspecies. So there are no taxonomic differences between jaguars in the Amazon and the Pantanal in northern Mexico. There are mild superficial differences, but so that jaguar corridor has to be run as a single ecological unit.
And that is relatively new science, too, about the jaguar genus and species. Yeah. Is that up until, I believe, like you write, the 1990s, they thought there were all these different kinds of jaguars, but it's really just one species of
one
jaguar.
One species of jaguars.
In 5,000 miles
right,
of...
Right. And that was a historic discovery.
And it changed conservation efforts for this animal.
It changed big cat conservation. It changed perhaps conservation in general.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was really a momentous, momentous discovery.
So as you followed in the path of Rabinowitz and you looked at his work and how that has led to the conservation efforts today, what do you see in terms of protecting the America's largest cat? What's being done and what needs to get done?
Oh, man, it's really complicated. The jaguar in the past 50 years has lost half its range. There are big infrastructure projects happening. There's industrial agriculture. There's the border wall, and then there's the ghastly international trade in jaguar parts. So the jaguar is up against a lot. And the kind of Pantanal model is it's few and far between. But most jaguar biologists who've studied jaguars for a long time believe that the jaguar is resilient enough, adaptable enough, and tenacious enough to survive and maybe even thrive. And Alan Rabinowitz used the phrase, he called them adaptable, but he said they had the audacity to survive. So that it's really a huge thing. And there's something called the 2030 roadmap that's very, very important. All the environmental organizations are participating in that. They're trying to create 30 more jaguar conservation units, which are the jaguar strongholds, and they're trying to connect corridors, many more corridors, by 2030.
What about the jaguar's impact on farming and cattle and human population? And I believe this is part of what you write where one of the Leopold family members steps in to say what they've observed.
Yeah, the Leopolds are just amazing to me. They always, always appear. So this is Starker Leopold, and he wrote a book called The Wildlife of Mexico, and he writes a lot about jaguars, and he pretty much says that jaguars prey on 85 different species. And the only time they really kill cattle is when there's an old injured jaguar and he takes cattle. One biologist said it was like going to Burger King and eating a Whopper for a jaguar because it's that easy for them to kill, you know, to kill a cow. But so Starker Leopold said that cattle were really not part of the jaguar prey template. They eat everything from frogs to skunks to armadillos to caiman. And sometimes they'll eat cattle. And of course, you know, the ranchers across the jaguar range are concerned about cattle.
Sure.
But there are depredation funds established. And with good cattle management, they can prevent that.
And Starker Leopold is one of the first to argue that, hey, they're not going to have that kind of an impact that you'd expect. And there are very few, if any, contemporary cases of jaguars attacking humans?
No, again, the humans are not part of their prey
template.
Well,
why wouldn't they attack humans? We would seem to be, to some degree, a good meal.
Yeah, right. There's almost no record. So there have been man-eating lions, man-eating tigers,
sure,
man-eating
bears.
Leopards, but there's no record of a man-eating jaguar. They don't attack people unprovoked.
Is there a case to be made, James Campbell, about natural selection that the bold, the brave, and the out jaguars were eliminated population-wise, and what was left were the ones who would slink through the night, who were very weary of humans and try to stay away?
Absolutely. I mean, you think of Lewis and Clark, and when they wrote about grizzly bears.
Yes.
They wrote about grizzly bears attacking them, and they put 12 musket balls into an attacking grizzly. But eventually, the grizzlies that survived survived were the grizzlies that knew how to hide, the grizzlies that move from, you know, the plains into the remote mountains. Those are the grizzlies that survived.
Yeah.
There was something called the jaguar tigreadas, when every jaguar had a bullseye on its back. And 180,000 jaguars were killed in Brazil alone in just over a decade. But what happened is the jaguars that survived were the jaguars that became more secretive, more elusive. So there is... there.
Wouldn't call it natural selection. It's almost like selection by human interference. Or...
yeah. Yeah, that's right. That's a really good point.
James Campbell, our guest, he is the author of the new book, Heart of the Jaguar. You probably know some of his previous works like Braving It, The Final Frontiersman, The Ghost Mountain Boys, and The Color of War. All of them have been featured in one way or another here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And if you have a question for our guest, we welcome you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us, talk@wpr.org. What did indigenous cultures think of the jaguar?
Oh, they worshiped the jaguar. It was incredibly important to their art, their architecture, their iconography, their mythology, their religion. I think in the book, that metaphysically, there was no more important animal to the essentially the southern people. The southern people worshiped the jaguar. Northern, say, Native American tribes worshiped the grizzly bear.
Mm-hmm.
So it was vital to them. For instance, the Maya believed that the jaguar protected the sun on its journey from day to night and back to day. That was the jaguar protector. And the Olmecs believed, the Olmecs of essentially the Yucatan in Mexico, believed that their ruling class the people of the ruling class were descended from the jaguar.
Kind of like Black Panther.
Yeah,
that's
right. Right.
What could I do, James Campbell? You're a Wisconsin author, you're from Lodi. But you have taken a stake in the future of the jaguar population in the Americas. If I, as a cat lover, would like to join you in this cause, what role can I play from here?
Well, there are a number of different big cat organizations. Panthera is the group that I primarily worked with, but there's the Wildlife Conservation Society. There's a number of other big cat groups that you can contribute money to, and there's some citizen science programs also.
Really?
That people might be interested in. Yeah.
Citizen science that I could participate in from here?
Yeah, well, no.
Okay.
Not from here. You could help set camera traps in southern Arizona, in the Sky Islands of southern Arizona, where there is a jaguar roaming right now named Cochise.
Cochise.
And periodically there is a jaguar in southern Arizona. So what they have is the University of Arizona set up this camera trap network throughout southern Arizona. So many people participate in that.
Is there any talk about restoring jaguar populations to the Arizona area? That's part of the corridor, as you mentioned.
Yeah, and I mean, once upon a time, up until probably 1850, there were jaguars in southern Colorado, in California, in West Texas.
It's almost hard to believe.
Yeah. We waged, as this man named Dan Flores wrote in American Serengeti, we waged a war of extermination against our predators.
Yeah.
The jaguar being one of them, of course, the wolf.
But the jaguar wasn't our predator.
Right. So... the jaguars are a cosmopolitan species. You know, they can live in the Amazon jungle. They can live in the Pantanal. They can live in the desert. They can live in the high mountains. In Arizona, there is a photo of a jaguar in the Huachuca Mountains standing in 6 inches of snow.
What?
They're incredibly adaptable animals.
That is, so from the deserts
from the
to
deserts,
the snow and all points in between, the rainforest,
right.
You name it.
I was in southern Bolivia in the Gran Chaco Forest, which is parched, brittle country, and jaguars thrive in that environment.
It just amazes me. And you go through we meet a number of these jaguars by name in your book, The Heart of the Jaguar. But with the time we have left, James, tell us about the one jaguar that sticks out in your mind, and you know why it stays with you today.
I think probably a very small female jaguar named Sophia. I was in the Brazilian Pantanal participating in a capture and collaring program. And this went on for about 10 days, 10 sleepless days and nights. And on the final night, we captured this female jaguar. And the protocol for taking care of a captured jaguar is really, really intense. I mean, it's almost a sacred act for these biologists.
And that's the way you write about it, is how, and the previous, you talk about how some of the earlier attempts to, you know, tag these jaguars led people to question whether or not they were helping or hurting these animals.
Yeah, definitely. And there was a time when that was a valid question, but losing a jaguar today from trapping and from trapping one is almost unheard of. I spent a lot of time in the Brazilian Pantanal with a guy named Joaris May. He's the world's leading jaguar trapper. He's trapped more than 110 jaguars. And he was the one who trapped this female jaguar named Sophia. And eventually they laid her on the tailgate of a truck. And then they have to do all kinds of various tests. And then what they told us was then we could touch the cat. And They took us through the whole protocol the first night, and then they reinforced that night after night after night. But never had they told us, had they told me about how emotional that experience would be to touch, you know, to touch a spotted cat, mm-hmm. a living thing. Mm-hmm. And I put my hand over its belly and felt it breathe, and I was just so close to it. It was really emotional.
Yeah. Sophia, you write about it. Was that the first tagging that you did of a
jaguar? That was the first and only tagging
and just
that
to
I did.
Pull it all together here. You mentioned how George Schaller was the mentor for Alan Rabinowitz.
Yeah.
And his lifelong friend, as you write, was Howard Quigley.
Yeah.
And it was Howard Quigley that invited you out to the Pantanal to do that tagging.
And Howard Quigley studied under A. Starker Leopold at Berkeley. So the Leopold surface again. And, of course, Aldo Leopold wrote a lot about jaguars, too.
I'm curious where you're at right now. James Campbell is a Wisconsin author who's been all around the world and has brought it all to us here on Wisconsin Public Radio. What's on your horizon? You got a next book cooking already, or are you?
I have a tough time staying put. Not that I don't love Lodi and I don't love Wisconsin. I love them both. But I consider myself kind of a boots on the ground author. Mm-hmm. I do not know what I'm going to do next, but I hope it takes me far afield.
What is the state of the jaguar population in the Americas right now?
Well, the IUCN, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, estimates that there are two different estimates. One is that there's 60,000 jaguars left in the world. Another estimate is 170. Most jaguars believe that it is 60,000 jaguars, but 80% of those jaguars are in the Amazon mm-hmm. and the Brazilian Pantanal. And remember, the thing I always point out when people say 60,000 jaguars, that's a lot. 180,000 jaguars were killed in Brazil between 1963 and 1975 to service the fashion industry.
And as you write, some of that continues today with Chinese medicine.
Yes.
And the need to protect our animals from commerce that is questionable at best, an international trade that has very few protections for those who need it the most.
Yeah, the international trade, the rates of international trade in jaguar parts is alarming. And there are networks that go right from Bolivia, right from Paraguay, right from Panama, straight to China.
James Campbell, I want to thank you for sharing your stories with us and with Wisconsin Public Radio through the years. And needless to say, we're excited to find out what's next. But take your time with us and come back when you
I'm
can.
I'm excited to find out, too. Thank you very much.
Pleasure's mine. James Campbell is the author of the brand new book, Heart of the Jaguar, The Extraordinary Conservation Effort to Save the America's Legendary Cat. Check it out when you can. Coming up next, Elaine Becker and Karen Mayhew join us to give us an update on gardening with sheep's wool. We feature featured them on Garden Talk last year on the Larry Mueller Show. We'll catch up with them in Argyle when we continue. Wondering how you can use wool in your garden? That story is next. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to the Larry Mueller Show. Turn waste wool from Wisconsin farmers into a sustainable and green peat alternative? For that, we turn to our next guests. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. And our guests are business partners Elaine Becker and Karen Mayhew. Their business is called Woolets. It's based in Argyle. Elaine's an educator and prairie enthusiast with a degree in environmental science, and Karen is a fiber artist, shepherd, and fourth-generation farmer with a background in large-market vegetable farming. So have you ever used wool in your garden? And what would you like to know about these wool pellets that are offering a sustainable alternative to peat? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email to talk@wpr.org. Elaine and Karen, welcome back to the Larry Mueller Show.
Hi, Lee. Thanks so much for having us.
Yes, Lee. Thanks.
And I would like to start with just the basics here, but tell us a little bit about what a woolet is and how you came to develop them.
Well, a woolet is essentially a wool pellet, or a pellet made of shredded up wool. The original idea came from Europe. A guy in Germany, whose name I can never remember, modified a wood pellet mill to handle all of the extra wool. And, you know, Europe has been ahead of us for centuries. They've always thrown their extra wool right into the garden, but it's a little slower to catch on over here. So I had been thinking about, you know, ways to use up a lot of the extra wool that we have on with our flock. And also a couple years ago, the largest Midwest wool buyer closed its doors permanently, and that left a large gap for anyone with wool to be able to do anything with it. So this is a way to create a new market for wool and divert wool that was getting thrown out, burned, whatever, just getting wasted back into the earth and back into the soil to regenerate it.
Wow. And how does wool work as a sustainable alternative to peat?
Well, for one thing, peat, you know, really needs to stay in the ground, because it is our third largest carbon sink. And every time that we harvest that, we're releasing carbon back into the atmosphere. Wool becomes a carbon sink itself. When you put it back into the ground, it holds the carbon there. And then as the wool breaks down, it releases that carbon back into the soil. So by turning that back into our ground, we're reducing the amount of carbon that's being released, leaving the peatlands where they are to continue doing their job, and also getting more wool being used up for something else instead of just wasted and laying in piles everywhere. You know, when you're throwing stuff into the landfills, it just becomes toxic sludge.
Yeah, yeah. And you can find out more about Woolets online at woolets.net. That's woolets.net. And check it out there. How long has Woolets been around now?
2 years. We're coming up on our second anniversary, actually, on the 1st of January.
Happy anniversary! And that's crazy because after 2 years, I hear that you're moving into a larger space.
We are moving out of the barn at my farm, which makes my husband happy. And we're moving a lot of stuff out of Elaine's basement, which makes her husband happy. So we've moved into a commercial space, an industrial space in Blanchardville, not far from the farm. And we have much larger machinery that has just arrived, and we will be able to really increase our production, possibly as much as quadruple our production. So
wow.
That means that we can buy a lot more wool from Wisconsin farmers.
Are there other companies like Woolets around, or are you, at least in our area, or are you the only one? This is the first I've heard of this, and maybe it's because I'm not European, but How novel of an idea is this?
Sure. Well, there is an idea. There is a guy out in Utah who also came up with the idea about the same time as the German person. And so he has a pretty big operation way out there on the West Coast. But there's a few pelleters in Wisconsin. Utopia up at the Woolen Mill up there in Viroqua. And then You and Me Wool Company, Beth up there at has Woolly Belly Pellets. So there are more than just us.
But,
as far as I know, of the local area, we're the ones that are kind of reaching out more commercially with garden centers and whatever to put the word out that this is a new opportunity to find, a sustainable alternative to peat. We're in about 15 different, we've got garden centers we've partnered with in about 15 states right now.
15 states. And there is some research ongoing, if I'm not mistaken. Is the University of Illinois looking at Woolitz?
Well, we had a little hiccup with that. And so that project has been a bit delayed, as sometimes happens with universities and research projects. So, but we're still hoping that that's going to come off without hitch before too long.
Yeah, what kind of research are we looking at?
Quite a bit of education with us.
Sure. You were on PBS's University Place this past summer.
We are indeed. That was very exciting.
Yeah. So what part of education here is part of Woolitz's business model?
How do I word that? I love to talk and I love to share with people what we can do. Yeah. Yes. You can tell that, can't you? Elaine is much more reserved. I love to share with people the opportunity that's here and provide more, more ways for people to use wool. We have 80,000 sheep in Wisconsin. I think about 50,000 of them right now are wool sheep, and that wool's getting wasted here. So I'm happy and thrilled to be able to educate people about the different ways that wool can be used in the garden and all the benefits that it has for our soil.
I did not know that wool was being wasted in Wisconsin. Is that in part because the wholesaler had closed shop?
Well, in part, but a lot of the wool market in general in the United States has really decreased over the years. Since its kind of peak in World War I, it's slowly just sort of withering away as, more and more microfibers have been developed, synthetic fibers are being developed.
Yeah.
There's less interest in wool. It's having kind of a comeback now. There's a few companies that are making only wool clothing, but a lot of our wool infrastructure for manufacturing is gone now.
Interesting. But this becomes a viable alternative to peat in the garden. What about the price comparison? Is it as affordable as peat?
Well, peat is pretty cheap as far as an actual cash cost, but the environmental and ecological cost is much higher than wool. Wool is, when we sell wool as a shepherd, we get from 1 to 5 cents a pound for it, typically, for our wool here in Wisconsin. It costs us $6 to $10 per head of sheep to shear them. So it's a continual loss. Elaine and I are able to buy wool from Wisconsin farmers at a fair price, and then that gives them another stream of income. But when you are figuring in the processing and whatever, it is a little bit more expensive cash-wise
upfront
to purchase something that is sustainable than just continuing to use peat. So it's a question of, for the earth, is the cost too high for peat? I think it is. Here's something that's getting thrown out and is now being used as a way to nourish our earth and rebuild our soil, regenerate our agriculture. To me, that's worth paying a little bit extra for.
What do they look like, these pellets look like, for those who haven't seen them? And what do they smell like?
They look like rabbit food.
Okay.
they look like gray or brown or black pellets, depending on what color the wool was. The only thing in them is wool. So when you open up a bag, it smells like sheep.
Yeah, okay.
So does it really smell like sheep poop? It just smells like sheep wool.
That's not one of my questions, but what about when it gets wet?
It still smells like wet wool.
Is it something that you need to add every spring to your garden? Is it something that it's once and done? And what kind of impact do these wool pellets have?
Well, if you dig it into your soil, they will break down completely in 6 to 12 months and release all of their nutrition into the soil for the plants. I like to add them here at my farm twice a year. I put them in the fall when I'm preparing the perennials beds to rest for the winter. Just dig in around with like a top dressing, and then all of the pellets break down over the winter. And then in the spring, when the plants are waking up and ready to start growing, that nutrition is released already and right there for them so they can start growing. And then I also give them another round in the spring to feed throughout the entire growing season. But another one of the main benefits of wool in the ground is moisture retention.
Yeah.
Wool holds 30 times its weight in water. So when you're adding wool to your soil, they will expand, hold on to that water, and then release it slowly as the soil dries out. So you can water about 25% less, which is fantastic in things like containers and garden raised beds and things like that.
That makes a lot of sense. Karen Mayhew and Elaine Becker joining us. Their business is called Woolitz. It'll celebrate 2 years come January, moving into a larger location and out of the family locations of the Beckers and the Mayhews. What questions do you have about Woolitz? Online at woolitz.net, 1-800-642-1234. As a gardener, how could you see these wood pellets being used? Give us an email as well anytime, talk@wpr.org. Our conversation about Woolitz continues next. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry Mueller today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. Tomorrow at this time, you'll have Turkey Confidential. From the folks at Splendid Table, a live call-in opportunity for you to get on-the-fly cooking advice before your turkey hits the table. Tomorrow from 11 to 1, join the folks from Splendid Table for a Thanksgiving Turkey Confidential. And we'll have Larry back with you on Monday. Coming up Monday on The Larry Mueller Show, we've got the songs of the season. We're going to usher in our Christmas time with some holiday favorites, songs that Larry loves. Tom Wilmoth will be along with his favorites, and we'll take your favorite holiday songs too. That's Monday on The Larry Mueller Show from 11 to 1. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Larry today, and our guests from Woolitz, Elaine Becker and Karen Mayhew. Woolitz are wool pellets that are an alternative to peat moss in your yard that would offer alternatives and also nutrients for your garden. What questions do you have for them? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. And Elaine, I've got a couple of emails here, so I'm going to start with you and ask. Sabi called but couldn't stay with us. Do you use both wool and the hide? And do you know anyone in Wisconsin who still tans hides?
Absolutely. We normally just use wool as wool pellets or the raw fleece as mulch, because you can use it on vulnerable landscapes as soil erosion control. It's a great conservation tool in that aspect. If you can, you can use an entire fleece. In terms of, do we know someone who tans? Yes, we absolutely do. It's the Driftless Tannery down in Argyle. Excellent tanners in a natural way, tanning in a natural way.
Perfect. Sue emailed us, and she absolutely hopes wool comes back because the environment does not need more microfiber fabrics. The overabundance of plastic, Sue says, is harmful to our environment and our human health. Smart wool and merino wool products are awesome and do not itch. I don't see a question in that, but I guess I'd ask you for a reaction, Karen.
Oh, we absolutely agree.
Agree.
You know, I'm a sheep girl. I love wool in any form.
Yeah, and so, but so does wool get a bad name or a bad rap for some reason?
No, it's just that it's a lot less expensive to use the synthetic fibers.
On the front end.
Synthetic fibers, are a lot of them come essentially from big oil, from petroleum products. So that's an infrastructure we have.
And that's a choice.
We need to start looking at the cost to the world and not just the cost to our pocketbooks. We need to look at habitat restoration and looking to the past. How did we use things in the past? And we need to bring those processes back to secure our future. Using wool as mulch or in a blend for your soil can create a more favorable condition for your plants. It can sustain them in a way that polybeads can't. As I mentioned before, it can stabilize vulnerable landscapes. You can use it as soil erosion control. But in addition, by using wool and waste wool, you can create a circular economy with your neighbors, where the agricultural byproduct is a conservation solution instead of another problem, another poly problem, another plastics problem.
Perfect.
Let's go. Something else too, Lee. Yeah. Wool actually feeds your soil microorganisms. Your soil biome, the microorganisms that make your soil healthy, need organic matter. And if you're adding synthetics of any form, whether it's synthetic fertilizer or whatever, you are not feeding your soil, you're feeding your plants. So using wool or any other kind of organic matter is going to feed the soil itself and make that healthier and better able to live.
Jolene emailed us. She loves the idea of the pellets, but would it be possible to use a wool mat as a weed barrier in the garden? Instead of using plastic with holes that let the water through, could you use a wool mat that would hold in the water and let it out as needed, but block the weeds?
Absolutely.
Perfect. Yeah, that makes sense. It sounds like exactly what you were talking about. I've got a couple of questions here on the phone at 1-800-642-1234 for our guests, Karen Mayhew and Elaine Becker from Woolitz in Argyle, online at woolitz.net. Dave and Appleton, we'll go to you next. Good afternoon.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. And I'm not sure if you covered this or not. I just tuned in. I have access to the dirty part of the wool after they shear the sheep and they have all this dirty wool left over. I don't even know what they do with it, if they dispose of it or what. Can that be used the same way? And if so, how much would I put down? Just bury a bunch of it in an area, or how would I use it?
We do actually pellet the dirtiest parts of the fleece. That actually gives it a way to be used. You can lay it on top and pack it down and make basically a mat of wool. Be aware that you will have to do a little bit of weeding if you do that, because, of course, sheep like to wear their food, not just eat it. So you will have some weed seeds that you don't have with the pellets, because the pellets are processed at 180 degrees. So they're sterilized. But you can absolutely do that. I have wool mulch, just laid wool fleeces all around my trees and fruit bushes and things like that. You can bury it if you want, and that's fine. It takes a couple of years for it to break down in the soil when it isn't pelleted, because it's the fibers aren't shredded up small first. Do not use it in an area where you're going to till. Or you will spend a lot of time picking it out of your tiller.
sounds like that's happened before. What are the effects on slugs and snails and other insects that might be in our garden from Woolitz?
Slugs and snails, they are repelled by the wool because of the barbed fibers in wool. So it makes their underbellies itch, and they prefer to move to greener pastures, so to speak.
Smoother pastures.
In terms of deer and rabbit, they don't like the smell of the lanolin. And lanolin can only be washed out of the wool at high temperatures. So lanolin will stay on the wool that you put in your garden, because rainwater is not obviously hot enough.
Sure.
To rinse any of the lanolin away. So the wool acts as a repellent for deer and rabbits as well.
A natural pesticide, a natural repellent, a nutrient for your garden, a conservation cover, all from wool? That is Woolitz, online at woolitz.net. We'll go to Paula in Caledonia next. Paula, good afternoon.
Hi, thank you. It's such an interesting topic. I really appreciate this, and I appreciate the work that you're doing. And I'm sorry if I missed this, but did you mention where can you purchase your pellets? Are they at, like, Tractor Supply or feed stores?
You can find them at any of the Jung's stores
in
Wisconsin. And we have a few other kind of small local areas. If you don't have a Jung's near you, you can buy them from us online at our website, woolitz.net. And we are expanding out all the time with new garden centers. So if there's one in your area that you'd like to see this see us carried in, let us know their information. We'll reach out, send them samples, and see if they might be interested.
Paula, thank you so much for the call. Kathleen emailed us, and she wants to know if you can compost sweaters. Kathleen has several 100% wool sweaters that are beyond mending. Can you put them in your compost bin? How long would they take to decay, or is there a better way?
Well, you can do a lot with an old sweater, actually.
Cool.
I would cut it up before you put it into your compost, but you absolutely can. Then the other thing that I like to do with them is cut them into small pieces or you know, like chunks and put them in the bottom of my pots before I'm filling it with soil. I use raw wool for that as well, but just adding a layer of a sweater in the bottom holds the soil in and it holds that moisture in there as well. So that's another option for you. You can even cut them up in cut up the center and then wrap it around a tree at the bottom and use it like a mulch. You can do whatever you can do with raw fleece or wool, you can do with the sweater as well. And it'll make your yard very colorful if you use it. I think that's fun.
I think it looks beautiful in my mind. I would love to see it. We'll go to Bob and Kiwani next. Bob, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I was curious about your packaging, what size, weight packaging it comes in, and what would be the typical application to get the desired effect on, say, a 10 by 10 garden area, 100 square feet?
Yeah, let's talk logistics.
All right, we have 1 pound packages, we have 5 pound packages, we have up to 25 pound packages, and 1 pound covers 30 square feet.
Okay.
So I can't remember what you said your square footage is.
Said Bob? 10 by 10.
10 by 10. And that should.
So that'd be 100 square feet. So the 5 pounds.
Would be a good deal.
A good way to do that. It would be close to it. You can broadcast it and work it in. And we always say that less is more because you can give it, it's got a lot of nitrogen. It actually has 9% nitrogen on average.
Whoa.
Yeah. But because it's all natural and it doesn't have the urea in it, it'll never burn your plants.
Okay.
So if you're going to broadcast, figure about 30 square feet for 1 pound. I like to just put it in when I'm planting or top dress around so I can make it go a lot longer or stretch it a lot further. But like the 25 pounds is, my numbers are, is that 150 square feet?
Oh, don't ask me to do math, please.
I haven't had enough coffee today to do math. But it is on our website. I think it's the 5 pound bag does 75 square feet. So that would work for you if you want to go just with your individual plants or around the individual plants, or if you just want to start building your soil up. And then the 25 pounds, I think, is 150 square feet. But we also can do bulk orders for people. I mean, we have done up to 1,000 pounds.
Whoa.
With our machines. So
wow.
You want to order that ahead of time since it's just Elaine and I. and we have day jobs. So we have to do this after our day jobs. But yeah, we can do any size for folks. But.
So this is a labor of love for you, a labor that is almost 2 years down the road, but also a commitment to educating folks about why Woolitz are a viable alternative. I've only got about a minute left here, Karen, but I want to know from you what your hopes are for the future of Woolitz and what you're doing.
Well, we are hoping to make this our full-time job eventually.
Yeah.
And focus on getting the word out as much as we can to everyone. You know, this is our effort. It's just two of us, but if we all make a little effort, if we all make a change, we can make amazing volumes of benefits and save the world. So, you know, our mission is to kind of save people and do our part.
So
we dream big.
Saving the world, I don't know of anything bigger than that. And if we all did a little bit, we'd go a long way. And perhaps wool as a viable and green, sustainable alternative to peat would be something that the future holds for many in Wisconsin and their gardens. Karen, Elaine, I want to thank you both so much for joining us today. And we look forward to catching up with you perhaps in another year or so. Just let us know what you're doing.
Thanks so much, Lee. It was great talking with you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Lee.
Elaine Becker, Karen Mayhew, the founders of Woolitz, based in Argyle. You'll find them online at woolitz.net. That is woolitz.net. Thanks to them. And thanks to you for joining us today in this season of Thanks. We are so grateful to have you on board on Wisconsin Public Radio. And I also want to thank the team that makes it so easy for me to sit in for Larry Mueller here. Clara Neipert, Joel Patinaud, Jeff Robbins, executive producer Jill Nadeau. We are all very thankful for Larry Mueller today, and he will be back with you live on Monday with the songs of the season, so don't miss that starting at 11 o'clock. And don't miss what's next here on WPR News. Lots more in store. I'm Lee Rayburn, and for Larry today, and you're listening to The Larry Mueller Show.